Tom Weber. This is NPR News. This hour, a look at poverty in the suburbs. And later, we're going to talk about a healing ceremony for St. Paul's Rondo neighborhood. That's coming up at the end of the hour. First, though, census data show the following. The number of residents who live in poverty in the suburban and rural part of the Twin Cities metro is greater than the number of residents in poverty in the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. So let me just say that again. There are more people in raw numbers living in poverty in the suburbs than in the two urban center cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. We're going to talk about this, whether the suburbs are equipped to address this and what they're doing now. And we have three guests to talk about this. Libby Starling is manager of regional policy and research with the Metropolitan Council. Her staff compiled a lot of the stats we'll be talking about today. Libby, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Tom.
Nora Slawick is the mayor of Maplewood, also a former DFL state representative. Mayor, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Rob Zeski is the CEO of the food bank, Second Harvest Heartland. Rob, I appreciate your time.
Good to be here.
Your questions and your experience. Maybe you've seen how these numbers, as we talk about them, you've seen how they've manifested in your area of the suburbs, if you live out there. What should the suburbs do to address it as well? I'd love to hear your thoughts and experiences. 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. So, Libby, let's just start with assumptions, I guess, maybe historical assumptions. Am I correct in assuming for a long time that the number of people in poverty in the two cities was more than in the burbs?
Yes, your assumption is correct. So poverty has traditionally been an urban and rural phenomenon. We used to see poverty in the central cities. We used to see poverty in rural areas. Think Johnson's Warren poverty. Mm-hmm. And we thought of suburban locations as areas that were wealthy, high income, growing. Over the course of the last decade, those trends have shifted. So since about 2010, we are now seeing more people in the seven county area who are in poverty living in suburban locations, as you said, outside of Minneapolis and St. Paul, than who are living in those two core cities.
So 2010 is when those lines crossed, I would say. Is that the right?
2009, 2010, right in there was really when we saw those two lines cross.
I can't help but think we were in the middle of a great recession at that time, too.
You are absolutely correct. One key thing to know is this is not unique to the Twin Cities by any means. Across the nation, all suburban locations are seeing these shifts. So this is one of those areas where the Twin Cities is following along with national trends.
I see numbers here about 385,000 people live in poverty in the suburbs. These are the estimates. 385,000 people. That is the population of St. Paul, actually. Or no, that's more than the population of St. Paul. St. Paul's about 300,000. So,
yes.
So you had 385,000 in the suburbs, 259,000 in the urban core. Is there anything about this? You've been studying this a long time. Were you surprised by these numbers?
We knew that these trends were changing nationally. So to that degree, it wasn't surprising to us. But it is shocking to actually see those numbers in front of us. One of the key things is that the share of our population who lives in the suburbs, about three quarters of the people who live in the seven county area live in suburban and rural locations. So about one quarter live in Minneapolis and St. Paul. So putting it into context, some of this is population growth overall mm-hmm. that is driving these trends, but there are other factors about the shifting economics of our suburban locations.
And we're going to get into also what are known as areas of concentrations of poverty. We'll talk about that. But Nora Slawick, I'm interested in your perspective. You were in the legislature at this 2009-2010 point. You're now the mayor of one of these suburbs. And maybe Libby saw this coming. Maybe the researchers had these numbers. But talk about the perception. Do we get it? Do we get that this has happened, that this is the new lay of the land?
You know, I think that's a good question. I think people are starting to get it as they move out into suburbs and people from the inner city tend to move into Maplewood. We have our southern part of the city that's by 3M that's much more like Woodbury. And we have our northern part of the city that's much more urban. And I think that's where we see a lot of the poverty issues. And we see it showing up in housing. Our housing stock is getting older and people are having trouble keeping up with their payments, which caused some of the foreclosure issues. We also have some issues around rehabbing. The city's going to be starting a pool and to help people rehab their homes because we see some of the poverty coming out. There's issues around transportation in our area. How do people get to work? You know, having a good job is really one of the fastest ways out of poverty, but people have to be able to get there. So Maplewood's also in a unique position. We're going to have the Gateway Corridor, which goes St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale, Woodbury.
The bus rapid transit line you're talking about.
Right. And then we have the rush line, which goes north-south. Mm-hmm. So it goes St. Paul, Maplewood, White Bear.
Although and there was an effort to get some money this year, and it didn't happen for the Gateway Corridor. But
we'll be working on that one.
That said, as you talk to maybe some of your former colleagues, your fellow mayors of the burbs, again, take that step back. Are they doing a good job of communicating this phenomenon to their residents?
Well, I'm part of the Regional Council of Mayors, which is the Urban Lands Institute brings us together. And I think that mayors struggle a little bit how to communicate that, right? Because people want that positive news and, you know, we want to do economic development and we're going to move forward. And it's harder. I mean, it's harder for people to talk about issues of poverty and what happens when people are struggling, whether it's in the schools, because it shows up in the schools with kids, whether they're hungry when they come to school or they don't have, you know, the adequate clothing, those types of things. It shows up again in the housing and those kinds of needs. And it even shows up, you know, Maplewood has a homeless population that sleeps in the park sometimes at night. So I think mayors, we're a little bit probably more reluctant to talk about it, but I think we want to do something. And that's where we got together and Alan Berube from the Brookings Institution came and we talked about what are the solutions. So we're trying to focus on what can we do to help our constituents understand, but really help our residents. I think that's the important thing.
Rob, I have to think a food bank like yours, and we've talked about this on this show and other reports here at NPR, with you, in fact, that you are probably an early indicator that maybe you see some of this stuff happening because of who the customers are and become at a food bank. So maybe you knew about this before even Libby did, as far as on-the-ground kind of research.
I think we've seen it for years. I'm not sure we have quantified it or necessarily always been as strategic as we could. I think a lot of our work is about responding to some more immediate need, but I think it's absolutely true. Anecdotally, the partner food shelves and meal programs and homeless shelters we work with and are seeing have seen growth much more quickly in terms of number of individuals and families that they're serving in the suburban areas than in their rural and urban counterparts. That's absolutely true. And as Nora said, I think we're finding that that's stretching some of our existing resources. So there have been a number of very interesting new investments and innovations on how we find those people, those neighbors that are in the suburbs but maybe struggling to get their way to services. But it has also been a really interesting and marketing and communication challenge to let people know that indeed we've got a whole new group of people in our midst that that we might not be aware of, and convincing our neighbors that indeed in Edina and Eden Prairie we have a need for food shelves. We have people really struggling to make ends meet, I think has been a big piece of our work as well.
So you're saying gone are the days of just finding the church in the urban center that's known to be the poor part of town and putting food shelves there. You're done. I mean, yes, those exist, but that's not the only way you can reach people anymore.
And they certainly do. And an interesting point about that is I think that in the urban core, many of those places are more geographically concentrated. And that has made some of the work simpler as we get into suburban and certainly rural areas. But as we're talking today with suburban, getting a little bit more creative and strategic about how we get to where those neighbors in need are is a very big piece of the challenge. And I think the coordination and collaboration that Nora was alluding to is a very exciting part of dealing with some of this new challenge.
Harder to walk to the food shelf in the burbs than if you were in the urban center there.
Exactly
walking
right.
To the church. We actually have a call here from Kathy in Hopkins, who I think you might know because she works at a meal program. Good morning, Kathy.
Hi, Tom. I work for Loaves and Fishes, Minnesota. Hi, Rob.
Good morning.
Good morning. We, in the last 2 years, have opened 14 new sites focusing on a missing meal map that Hunger Free Minnesota put out. And so we've landed meal programs out in Hopkins, Brooklyn Center, Egan, Invergrove Heights, Hastings, and we just opened a site in Plymouth this week. And when we open the doors, people come and they dine with us and they're hungry. So what you're talking about is really important.
How, Kathy, for someone who runs a nonprofit like this, I don't know how long you've been at the organization, but are you turning the organization on its head and trying to figure out how to serve the most people? I mean, are you failing in some ways because this trend takes so long to get caught up to?
The trend does take time to catch up to, and so does the funding. Rob and I have conversations about this quite often, that it's important that we keep talking about hunger, because the recession, while it might be over, for many, it is not. And they're coming to food shelves and to our meal programs, and Rob's having to push more food through the food bank so loaves and fishes can make more meals. It's just a cycle that continues, and I'm so glad that you're talking about it.
Kathy, thanks so much for the call. I appreciate it. We'd love to hear your experience as we talk this conversation here about this trend that Libby Starling from the Met Council was detailing with the data about more poverty in the suburbs. In some ways, this is not a super new story. The numbers had been moving that way, but as Libby talked about with those data since 2010 especially, more people live in poverty in the suburbs than in Minneapolis and St. Paul. 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. Libby, does this get evened out, though? I think about the amount of poverty or the numbers of people in poverty. To what Rob said, though, geographically speaking, that might be more concentrated. I'm just wondering if your numbers on the suburbs get somehow evened out because there's more land in the suburbs. It takes up more land area.
In looking at concentrated poverty, there's been a lot of research recently about the detrimental impacts of households, particularly children, living in areas of concentrated poverty. And while we'd like to think that suburban poverty is more dispersed, we are also seeing pockets of concentrated poverty where high numbers of people are living below poverty thresholds, even in suburban locations. Mm-hmm. So again, in 2000, we saw no pockets of concentrated poverty in suburban locations. We're now even seeing concentrated poverty in a range of suburbs, from Coon Rapids to Savage to Brooklyn Center to Shakopee. So those pockets exist even in suburban locations.
You're saying pockets of poverty. There's a formula you use with data and the number of people living in this area compared to the population of that area who live in poverty. And if it reaches a certain point, that's a pocket of poverty is what you're talking about.
Right. To give some context for this, and I apologize for the numbers and the wonkiness, to identify that, we look at 185% of the federal poverty line, which aligns with eligibility for free and reduced price lunch in schools, is similar to subsidized housing. For a household of four people, that means they're earning less than $44,000 a year. So think about what that means for wages, how to fit in housing, to fit in food, to fit in healthcare. When more than 40% of an area's population lives below that threshold, we're calling that an area of concentrated poverty.
Nora, I don't see any tracks. I don't see any pockets per se in Maplewood. I see a few that border you in Roseville and St. Paul. Do you sit back and look at this map here that Libby's talking about and just say, well, it's only a matter of time and we got a plan? Is that the mindset?
I think that's part of it. You know, I'm on the Met Council's Transportation Advisory Board, and this is how we allocate our funding, is looking at some of that concentrated poverty. So there are some debates about that and if that reflects what's happening or whether if the funding should track with that. I think that, you know, we're a first-tier suburb of St. Paul, and we do see a lot of the problems that have happened in St. Paul coming out to the suburbs, whether it be problems with police issues. You know, in the area of, we have Rice and Larpinder, which has had some shootings and things lately. We see for poverty issues coming out, again, you know, with schools and with kids and people needing things. So I think in Maplewood, we're definitely seeing, you know, from the urban core coming out to our city.
What is the mayor's proper role here, do you think? Is it to say it's probably coming, so let's get ready for it? Or is it to say, no, there are tools we can use locally here to prevent it from getting here?
I think a couple things. I think it's important for mayors to head on acknowledge that there is poverty in their cities. And I think the regional council mayors, that was acknowledged. And I think as mayors, what we want to look at is that regional approach. So what can we do together on housing? How can we get those mixed income housing developments so that we get all those income levels? And we've got one of those coming into Maplewood. We've got a old bowling alley that's boarded up it's going to be a new housing development. So there's ways to kind of stay ahead of the curve. I think it's also looking at workforce development for the mayors and how we do that. We had an intercultural fair in Maplewood where we had the chambers from the Hmong community, the Latino community, from the we had Karen folks involved. And so we're trying to get ahead of that curve and acknowledge, you know, I think for us, we want to embrace this. I mean, this is about who we are. It's not that way in all of the suburbs. I will tell you that, right? Because as you go farther out, I think people don't expect as much of it. But I think the mayors need to be leaders. I was at the ULI Housing Conference. It's a national conference here in the Twin Cities. We toured St. Louis Park and Hopkins projects. And it's impressive what they've been able to do in areas of poverty to build affordable housing to lift their cities up. And the mayors really have to be the visionaries. Yeah. We're the ones that have to lay out what's the vision for helping people.
It is out there. Shakopee, Savage, Apple Valley, Rosemont all have at least one area that's considered a pocket of poverty. That's interesting. Patty is on the phone here this morning in Bloomington. Good morning, Patty. Your thoughts?
Well, thank you for having me on. I'm calling on behalf of VEEP, Volunteers Enlisted to Assist People. And we've been actually operating in the suburban communities of Bloomington, Richfield, and Edina, and part of South Minneapolis for 42 years. So we've been trying to tell the story of suburban poverty for a very long time. We operate the largest food shelf in the state of Minnesota. About 10,000 people benefit each and every month from our food program.
Patty, thanks so much for the call and the perspective there. Rob, tell me how this then plays out. How does this mean you have to open more offices in the suburbs, right? I mean, how is your job different today? Say more about that. You were alluding to it earlier.
Well, I think one of the neat things about our work, and I think this is true of many other sectors serving our low-income neighbors, is it's a very dynamic group, and it has been responsive as this have changed the VEEPs and the loaves and fishes that have called in. And so I think there's several things. We certainly, number one, live in a world where we have a lot of data. And so as a previous caller alluded, there's a lot of information for us to be able to pinpoint our work. We've worked with Boston Consulting Group recently to be able to understand the census track level, where ought we be targeting our programs in a much more detailed way?
How are the customers different? How are the customers that you have different than they were 10 years ago?
Yeah. Well, I think there's a couple things. I think one of the first ones we know is we just did a quadrennial survey and found that only 3% of the people that we served in last year were homeless. 97% were in homes. And so by and large, as we think about that trend reversing, that used to be a much higher percentage, that's changed. We've seen that by and large, people are working. 71% of the people we served had jobs within the last year of our survey. And so as we think about the needs for our organization, the hours that we're open, mm-hmm. the places that we're located, the types of food, we know that that's a changing demographic, not only just a growing one, but those have different characteristics than they might have 10 years ago.
Alex online here in St. Louis Park says, I work for the Census Bureau. Police are working to get homeless people off the street in the city, but not in the suburbs. If it affects the numbers, or it does affect the numbers that we're reporting here as well. Libby, this is actually an issue, another issue that's tied to this, for which you were actually on this show recently, has to do with affordable housing, has to do with things like Nora, what she has to deal with in her city in Maplewood. Where do you put affordable housing? And frankly, you are well aware of critics who will say, well, it's actually that regional approach and mandating where affordable housing goes that has caused some of this problem. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy that if you put affordable housing in X city, that's where you're going to have more poverty. How do you look at that topic within this larger issue?
For the council's critics who would say that the council is behind some of this, and I've certainly read some of those comments about the Metropolitan Council, I think it's important to note that the suburbanization of poverty is a national trend. And so looking at this independent of where affordable housing is, in many of these suburban locations, it's not that people are moving to the suburbs because of particular opportunities. It is people who have been living in suburban locations who are seeing their economic circumstances change. So looking at the changing job market, changing demographics, changing housing market. So people are living in areas and seeing their incomes fall overall.
I've read that as well. I've also read that there is another facet, that there are some people moving out to the suburbs. Maybe their situation within the city changed, so they're looking for lower rents or lower price land, and or maybe looking for foreclosed properties. I mean, isn't that a second population that's moving out to the suburbs and becoming part of these data?
I think the other phenomenon that's important is that we are seeing increased interest in living in central locations. So we're seeing rising rents in Minneapolis and St. Paul, lower vacancy rates. The core cities are becoming more desirable places to live, which drives up housing costs, and much of the middle-aged, older housing, the housing that was built in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, is now getting to that awkward age where it needs the rehabs, it needs the investments. And so lower income households are able to move into those homes because they've been priced out of living in the core cities.
When we talk about concentrations of poverty, and there are still more tracks, I guess, that would have concentrations of poverty that you're talking about, pockets in Minneapolis and St. Paul, because of the because of how closely together we live in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Is it skewing the suburban numbers? Are these few suburbs where the pockets are showing up, is that skewing it for the rest of the suburbs? Is this story a little off, is what I'm saying, to say that when you have these numbers where there are these higher concentrations in the burbs, that's actually going to skew it for the rest of the burbs?
What we're seeing is rising suburban poverty across suburban locations.
So even though there's more concentrations in these one areas, overall it is also going up.
Overall, it is also going up.
Nora, what would you add to that?
I think Libby makes a lot of really good points. I mean, we do see the rising suburban poverty. We see increasing diversity. You know, Maplewood has a large Hmong population. Again, Karen, Latino population. I mean, we are definitely seeing all of that ramping up. I think that, though, your point about people moving to the suburbs and having it be more desirable, and that's the millennials. You know, I will tell you where our housing stock of the 50s and 60s is also has the Gateway Trail, the Vento Trail, Lake Phelan. It's where the transit lines will go through. And then it has Frost and English, where we have the boarded up bowling sites. So it's kind of these trade-offs where we see people, as you sort of say, Libby, is this poverty in place, right? You're in the same place, but you don't have as much income. Costs have gone up. So I think that, you know, in Maplewood, we're trying to be very aware of that and putting programs together. We're doing the rehabbing program, doing things to support folks, incumbent worker programs, green working programs to support our population, as well as, you know, we're home of 3M, you know, and we have St. John's and we have Maplewood Mall. So we have a lot of really successful companies and businesses in Maplewood, and getting that in the mix too, you know, making sure that they're aware of it, but that they're also, we have a lot of retail jobs that hopefully are paying enough of a living wage.
Let's get one other thought in here before we go for news. Cheryl in Oakdale, what's your experience here this morning, Cheryl?
Yeah, hi. My name is Cheryl Peterson. Hi, Nora.
Oh, hi.
I work at Guardian Angels Church in Oakdale, and we are aware of poverty out in the suburbs, and this is a problem that is bigger than the churches are able to respond to. There are 30 churches in this part of town who have come together to open a volunteer-run shelter for families experiencing homelessness. It's in the former rectory on site at Guardian Angels. It's housed 131 families, over 400 people since we opened. And these are people predominantly from the suburbs who are experiencing homelessness. So I think your program is really important because we need to create the political will that says, let's raise wages, let's have enough housing that's affordable so that we treat people with dignity.
Cheryl, thanks so much for the call here. Nora, doesn't that kind of a thing come up in city council meetings, the debates about Do we need a homeless shelter? Do we need a food shelf? Do we need more affordable housing?
It does. And then often that can tax our services, which are the police and the fire and the medical folks. And so we look at those, and we're partnering with various organizations, such as the food shelves and other places, to help get the services to people. But for a city, does it put some taxing on our services to have more people in poverty? It does.
Well, I was also alluding to opposition at those city council meetings.
Yes.
These are not universally adored proposals when they come before a city council.
Exactly. And of course, we're nonpartisan, right? So people go all over the place on these things. But yes, our council can be divided on some of those issues, whether it's good for the city or not good for the city. You're right. And we have those debates right now. I think we have a very mature council. We have an excellent staff, and we're able to move some of this forward, but we've also got to balance the rest of our needs.
What's the list here, Rob? What would be the list of things? I hesitate to say, you know, what are cities doing or are they prepared? Because it's here, right? They need to be. If they're not, what's the list of things that these suburbs need to do to make sure that they are addressing this changing paradigm?
I think the thing we hear most from the food shelves that we work with is the transportation, and that's a barrier across many functions. That's a job question. That's getting to services question. So I think that's one that we hear the most about. But I think there's a number of other things that our list is topped by things like collaboration, how we can start to get creative with other partners. So we're now working with healthcare clinics and the hospitals in how we think about delivering food security through providers' offices, which is a very interesting new opportunity for us. Mm-hmm. Same thing with schools that are endowed with fantastic hunger relief programs that aren't always optimized. So as we think about this, it's not always building the new standalone facility or a bricks and mortar facility. It's how do we get creative about coordinating with the local common bond or the local school to figure out how we triangulate some of these services for the populations that we're serving in common?
If transportation is a big issue, though, Nora, and I know it is in Maplewood, do you also have to rethink how the suburbs look, how they're designed, where the sidewalks are, how far the houses are off the road, whether it's more dense, those kinds of things?
Absolutely. I mean, it goes into a lot of the planning and design of the cities, and we do go for a lot of grants where we're putting in more sidewalks right now. There has to be more density, and that's the trend. So people are in the burbs aren't necessarily as much used to that. But we have call it a living streets program in Maplewood, where we actually look at all of that and mm-hmm. making it more livable yet more effective at the same time.
Libby, a question here online from Gloria says, aren't there more jobs in the suburbs? And if they are, why is there so much poverty out there? Do we know?
To answer the question, yes, there are more jobs in the suburbs. There are more people in the suburbs. There are more jobs in the suburbs. But as we look at what types of jobs exist and overall the decline of the jobs that don't need higher levels of education, overall across the region. So 30, 40, 50 years ago, a person could move into a manufacturing job with a high school education and live a middle-class lifestyle. Many of those middle-income jobs have simply disappeared, so we see more higher-income jobs, and we see more of the lower-income personal care, health care, retail, the jobs that cannot support a family on one income.
You see that?
We really do. I mean, and that's this new mixed income development we're doing in the Gladstone area. The rents are going to be $600 to over $1,000. And, you know, for people working retail jobs, some teachers, professionals, police officers, that's considered, you know, pretty hefty rent, although that's actually affordable these days. So we agree if people aren't making enough, if there's not a livable wage, they're in poverty and have trouble getting out of it.
Margaret is in Eagan this morning. Good morning, Margaret. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm a millennial. I am also employed by the Open Door Pantry in Eagan, so I see a lot of these issues, and I actually had the privilege of attending the Confronting Suburban Poverty seminar that Second Harvest Heartland put on back when the Brookings Institute was here. So I appreciate that opportunity. I just wanted to reflect upon my personal experience, though. As a millennial that I currently actually live in Minneapolis and work at the Open Door Pantry, which is in Eagan, and we rent right now, but we're in the market for a house, and I see a lot of my friends really shunning the suburbs and wanting to move into the cities. A lot of the jobs are here in the cities, especially I'm college educated. Most of my friends are college educated. They are finding jobs here in the urban core, and so wanting to live here close. They want to live by transportation. They want to be near restaurants and whatnot. And so but we're looking to actually move to the suburbs because we're seeing that housing is a lot more affordable there. And both my partner and I are employed in the nonprofit sector. So we're definitely seeing a lot of those trade-offs. And I really want to emphasize the point also that the living wage issue is probably, I think everything comes back down to that, is that we're really seeing a huge issue in just having enough money to get by. And man, we're college educated and we're having a hard time. So I can't imagine people that are, new to this country or that didn't have the privilege of being able to get a college education or some training beyond high school.
Margaret, thanks so much. I appreciate the perspective. Rob here, the stats show this across the whole Twin Cities, the whole population, 24% of the population's under 18. Among the areas of concentration, it's 29% are under 18. Now, that's only 5% difference, but I wonder if that's a sign of things to come.
Yeah, I think we're certainly concerned about that. We're concerned when we talk about the things to come about the senior population and the baby boom. We know one of the fastest growing sources of people in need of food shelf services will be those over 50. And so I think those are several groups that we're very concerned about. And I think one of the things that when we talk about the characteristics of this population of whether they're younger and we think about the working poor, the people with jobs that are not able to make ends meet, these are people typically trying to do all the right things. And one of the challenges that they have is a lack of assets. So even when they're working, when something changes in their job or a medical condition or a broken car can be the thing when you have no assets that spirals you into need. So it's not even below that poverty or 185%. I think we're seeing a huge population of people that are living paycheck to paycheck, which means things that other people might be able to bounce back from quickly cannot.
Rob Zeske, CEO of the food bank Second Harvest Heartland, thanks so much for your time here today. Come back and talk about this some more, will you?
My pleasure. Thank you.
Nora Slawick is the mayor of Maplewood. I appreciate your time as well.
Thank you.
And Libby Starling from the Met Council. Very interesting data. Come back and talk about it as well some more.
Happy to.
More conversation, as always, at nprnews.org.